You're listening to High Control, a podcast about identifying, leaving, and recovering from high control, high demand groups, also known as cults. We're not experts, but we do know what it's like to be a part of and then leave a cult. Your high control journey starts now.
Welcome to the High Control Podcast. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my friend, Allie Henney. And the High Control Podcast is a podcast that is designed to share with you our experiences in high control religion. And both Allie and myself have had those kinds of experiences, and we're utilizing the platform of this podcast to talk through some of the issues that resonate with us, and I'm sure resonate with others. Allie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I'm glad to be here. I will admit though, I'm a little bit sad because this is the end of season one, and this has been such a great, fun experiment.
Absolutely.
I really hope our audience has been enjoying this show as much as I've been enjoying creating this show.
Absolutely. It's an honor to share our experiences with others, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to hear from you as well. And the episode title for today's conversation is residue, and the definition of residue is the small part that remains after the main part is gone. And a lot of times when we think of residue, it tends to have a negative connotation. We don't necessarily think of it in good terms. But for our purposes today, when we talk about the residue that remains in both of our lives on this side of high control religion experiences, I think we can both agree that there is some good as well as a lot of bad that we are still dealing with beyond our cult experiences, our experiences in high control religion. For me and for you somewhat, although at different times and to different degrees, we both experience life within the United Pentecostal Church. And I know one of the big struggles for me on the other side of that is dealing with a loss of identity. A lot of my identity was wrapped up in the United Pentecostal Church, especially as someone who identified as a preacher. And later, even though I had left that particular organization attempting to lead a church as a pastor, a group of people that had the same sort of experiences within the UPC that I had, and endeavoring to find my footing and where I belonged. And I think identity is something that a lot of people struggle with after their cult or high control religious experiences, because by definition, the cults, the high control religions structure so much of our lives. It is wrapped up everything about who we are, how we express ourselves, how we relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And I was talking with someone this week, and we've touched on this before, about my experiences in the United Pentecostal Church. So much of what we did was put into terms of transactional relationships, yeah, what we could do for one another. And a lot of that was because that was how we were taught to relate to God. We put out a certain amount of energy in worship and in praise and in song, or we were expected to give sacrificially of our time and our talent and our treasure. And based upon that giving, we entered into this transactional relationship with God where we had mm-hmm. the expectation that we were going to get something in return. Yeah. And as a result of that false understanding of what a relationship with God looks like, we also had a difficult time relating to other people. It was all based upon what we could do for one another. And there was, within at least my experience, within high control religion, there was no concept of loving another person and simply accepting them for who they were, and understanding that we're all people in process. And that's what high control religion does. It attempts to manipulate the identities of people so we all assimilate into this culture where we become cardboard cutouts of one another that reflect whatever the leadership wants us to reflect. And we lose identity within the cult. And so on the other side of the cult, we struggle with a loss of identity. And for me, that has been the residue in a negative sense that has defined the last several years of my life.
Yeah, you know, I think that the transactional nature of these groups is something that I also have long struggled with, simply for the fact that, and I've mentioned this in a previous episode, that it's almost like in some cases whenever you leave these groups, people just don't have object permanence for you. It's kind of like you're out of the group, and so then we don't know how to talk to you anymore. We don't know how to interact with you. And I will say that in my experience, that was much more true for my experience in the UPC and then also my experience with the wall. Less so with the furnace. I think, like, I have friends, I have people that I still talk to today from that era of my life. You know, we're not necessarily in one another's lives in the same way. And some of that is also because, you know, I moved cross country after I left. My leaving was, I wasn't still there in Virginia. I had moved back across country. So there's also kind of some of the natural, I'm no longer in proximity to people. And so then, because I'm not in proximity to them, it does, you know, friendships are harder to carry through whenever there's long distance. It's definitely possible. I mean, our friendship has been a long distance friendship for like the past 15 years. Sure. So it definitely is possible. But you know, it's an understandable effect that those relationships would take a hit and would diminish. But with leaving the UPC, something that I felt immediately were the people who, because, you know, I had got my nose pierced, like literally we had our business meeting on a Monday night, the one that we voted to leave the UPC unanimously as a church. I want to say it was like the next day. I think it was like a Tuesday. I went to the parlor and got my nose pierced. And like, that was something that I knew, like, I wasn't breaking any rules at that point. And so as a leader, I mean, I didn't care about the rules, but as a leader, it was my job. And so I didn't want to create a situation. But then after that, it was like, well, no, this is the natural outworking of, you've removed these holiness standards. And so like the natural outworking then is, if you're not going to control how people dress and how they look, then you have to accept that your new youth pastor has a nose ring now. And that's just the way that it is. And so, and I mean, it was a thing for some of the people who remained in the church. It was a thing for some of them. But again, they realized that they couldn't say anything to me about it because it's like, who's gonna check me? We don't have the holiness standards anymore. Who's gonna check me? But then that act also caused me to lose a relationship with, because I was a youth pastor. There was a family that was connected to our youth group who the parents didn't want their kids to be around me anymore because of this. It was like that was a bridge too far for them. And I experienced, I feel like, a lot less of the relational losses from the UPC because a lot of the people who I was close to made the transition, made the change. I was already friends with some of the people who were like, yeah, some of this stuff needs to change. So I didn't really suffer any major losses, but I do remember seeing people around me who they lost like 20-year friendships because they had people not talk to them because all of a sudden, you know, they had changed their appearance. I mean, I knew people whose family really struggled and really had issues, and it created rifts in families because of that. And that's something that, as a bystander in those instances, even that I always really, really struggled with, because it's like, you didn't actually care about these people. Like, you didn't actually care about me as a person. You saw me as like an entity or an actor within the system. And once something about me changed, then all of a sudden, you know, you're not friends with me. And actually, as I say that, I did lose some friendships with the Furnace, but it wasn't, but the thing is that it wasn't me leaving that left those friendships. It was when I started being vocal about LGBT, about racism, which some of them, you know, knew me whenever I was vocal about racism, because I was vocal about racism whenever I was there, and became more vocal, even more vocal after I left, and I felt the safety of leaving and like, oh, it's not going to be divisive and it's not going to whatever. But whenever I just say like how I came out for LGBT issues, like I'm straight, I'm cishet. Like there was no coming out for right. me, but being a person that, became that, you know, came to my own, understanding and awareness of those issues and realizing that like I couldn't remain silent, in the face of the things that our friends in the queer community were experiencing. That was something that I think the combination of the racism and the being pro-LGBT, it was like, oh, you're not one of us anymore. So we got to put distance. And so it was just that was interesting. Those losses were interesting.
It is extremely interesting that you mentioned the fact that people saw you not as a person, and I experienced this as well, but rather as almost a placeholder of somebody that represented the cult or the high control religion. And once you deviated from the expectations of what people had always viewed that to be, then all of a sudden you were a non-entity.
Yeah.
And I think that's the nature of these high control religious groups and cults, is that the culture, right, it perpetuates the systemic nature of the control. And what I mean by that is that you can deviate within acceptable parameters mm-hmm. within the organization. But the moment that you push back against what has always been accepted behavior or behavioral expectations within the group, and you choose to deviate from that, depending upon what the deviation is, dictates how great the relational loss is going to be. And I'll give you an example of this. I served in some what would be considered more progressive United Pentecostal churches during my tenure as a youth pastor, as an assistant pastor, both in Arkansas and in Louisiana. And during particular seasons, for instance, a lot of the men, they would grow facial hair, right, during mm-hmm. No Shave November. And, you know, people would talk and they would smile and they would laugh. And that was something that was accepted as a deviation for a particular time. Mm-hmm. Or if the men were participating in an Easter play or a Christmas play where they were looking like biblical characters, it was okay to grow this facial hair. But there was an expectation that at some point the facial hair was going to go away. And for those few that may have said, well, I'm going to retain the facial hair, it was like, well, okay, we'll tolerate that. Mm-hmm. And then also in these more progressive United Pentecostal churches, there was some acceptance of minor deviations from the dress codes mm-hmm. for women. Again, depending upon the season, if you were to trim your hair and maybe no one noticed, if you kept it wearing it up and no one would notice, that was okay. But what became problematic in the United Pentecostal Church was where you chose to deviate. So if you were at a particular conference and you were with a group of other churches and there was this overall expectation that you had to toe the line, then a lot of times leaders within our local church, they told my wife, because she trimmed her hair from time to time, well, you want to wear your hair up at this particular conference, because we don't want to cause any issues or cause anyone to stumble with our quote unquote Christian liberty. So this kind of hypocrisy was engaged in all of the time. And depending upon the church or depending upon the region, certain deviations were tolerated. But the moment you took a stand and said, the obvious, right? What everybody understood to be true, but no one was willing to say, all of this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you took a stand for that, then immediately people began to talk about you, and your influence waned with particular leaders. And that's something that I certainly saw in my life. There were certain things that I could question freely and openly, like a lot of our methods in evangelism and our tactics for soul winning. But the moment that I began to question any of the fundamental doctrines or any of the long-held traditions that passed as holiness standards, if I began to question that too much, or was too vocal about pointing out the inconsistencies and just the plain nonsense that none of these issues had anything to back them up, then that was the moment that I began to be marginalized within the group. Because again, they don't care about you necessarily as a person, but they care about you as someone who represents perpetuating the organization. And so the old axiom that culture eats strategy for breakfast applied, because you know, you could come in with all of these ideas and new strategies about soul winning, and as long as it served the greater purpose of perpetuating the accepted culture, then you were okay. But the moment you deviated too far out of line, then you were marginalized.
Yeah, you know, that was something that I always thought was really interesting, I guess, for want of a better word, within the UPC. But I guess, honestly, I could probably generalize that to other groups I've been part of, that there is like this acceptable way that you could exist within the organization. And like, you know, there was this idea that, at least where I was at, you know, people would say like, oh, that's, you know, that's edgy, or oh, this group is edgy, or like whatever. And edgy kind of meant like, you know, you're on the edge of what is acceptable, and you're kind of pushing that envelope and pushing what some of those norms and stuff were. But whenever I look back now, and I was self-aware at the time, but definitely looking back, I can see where like some of it was just so like petty. So like at the time, it was like, yeah, this is like, oh my gosh, look, we're doing this. This is, and I would make fun of it at the time. But then it was still like, you know, feeling some of the chains of like, I think that this is ignorant. And at the same time, I don't want to, you know, push too far, do too much, because then people will create issues, and it will create controversy. And I'm not necessarily trying to create controversy here. It's just that something for me, as somebody who, you know, I didn't grow up in the UPC, so there were all these little kind of rules and social norms that people had that were maybe, some of them maybe were unique to even to our congregation, that like I didn't know. And so there were things that I would say and do just as a matter of like, this is who I am. And people just automatically would be nervous about me. And that was something, and, you know, thinking then again about residue, you know, from a cult, I remember, you know, again, you know, as a youth pastor, I was in youth ministry. That was my primary involvement whenever I was in the UPC. And I remember people constantly treating me like I describe it as like being treated like mercury, right? So like, you know, mercury is a metal that it, here on Earth, it is kind of a liquid. It kind of goes between liquid and solid state, depending on the temperature. That's why, you know, mercury is used to indicate temperature, or used to be used to indicate temperature in thermometers. Mm-hmm. But mercury can be toxic whenever it's not handled right. And so like if a mercury thermometer breaks and you get it on your skin, it can absorb and it can make you very ill. So I grew up in an era where, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, where mercury stuff, it had been out of favor before, but because, you know, I was from a small town, like, you know, at our school and stuff, there were still some things that we would run across something that had mercury, like in the science lab or something like that, like something that hadn't been discarded. And whenever that would happen, it would have to be treated, you know, very carefully. And the science teacher, you know, would have to, you know, go through like all this protocol and stuff of disposing it. And so it was something, mercury was something that was always handled very delicately because it could be dangerous. And so I felt like that people treated me like I was mercury. Like if I, like somehow like I was dangerous, and I never could. And some of this is just straight up is racism is why, like, it was racism and sexism, misogynoir, like that, like that, like I want to name that just, you know, off rip, like that was what it was. But the thing, and I recognized that at the time, but the thing that was difficult was that, like, you know, I followed the rules. I yeah. followed the standards. I was like, you know, again, like I did not darken the door of a movie theater for 5 years. Did not darken the door of movie theaters. Meanwhile, you know, other people are going to IMAX. I was very judicious. So like, you know, we were early adopters of Netflix and stuff. We weren't allowed to watch movies that were rated above PG-13. I got rid of all of my rated R movies, of all my rated R DVDs. Or actually, no, better stated, I did not get rid of them. I don't think. I think I put them like completely away. I don't even know why I didn't just, I think I was like, I'm not like, this is like represents like money or whatever. I didn't right. watch any of them, but like I put them away. And I think like, it was like, you know, with the intention of like, you know, maybe giving them to family members or something like that. But even like stuff, like we didn't even watch things that were like PG-13. Like we stuck to stuff that was, you know, rated PG. Very rarely would we like watch things that were PG-13. You know, it was very judicious about what I watched, very judicious about the music that I listened to, about new entertainment and all this other type of stuff. So I was really trying to live the thing. You know, I was really trying to do the thing. You know, my skirts were always, you know, long, or like you came well below the knee. Even whenever I was sitting down, I always wore, so just it happened to also be in style too, where, you know, I wore like, you know, I would wear 3 or 4 layers because all the stuff was, you know, back in the early mid 2000s, all the materials were really super thin. But I would have my shirt, and then I would have like it'd be a short sleeve shirt, and then I have another shirt on it underneath it that, you know, at least like was closer to my elbow than it was to my shoulder, which was right. the standard, which is super, you know, arbitrary, but that was what the standard was. And then underneath that, I would be wearing like a tank top or whatever that you know, came down that was big and came, you know, way down past my belly. So if I lifted my hands, if I moved or whatever, like you weren't going to see my back, you weren't going to see my side, you weren't going to see my belly, you were going to see nothing of the midsection. Like I was, and it wasn't because like I felt like those things were wrong. It was like, I'm just like, this is the standard, and like I want to be a good example, and I'm a leader and all this other type of stuff, and I don't want to cause other people to sin or stumble or whatever the situation was. But I worked so hard within that system to adhere to and abide by the system. You know, I didn't use bad language, like I didn't whatever, but still something within all of that, still people pegged me because, I mean, like, you know, I dressed and I was, you know, I was, whenever I was in high school and stuff, like I was a punk, like that was a lot of my style. And so I tried to translate that into my UPC style. So like, you know, I'm wearing skirts, but then like I've got, you know, these long, like striped socks that I got from Hot Topic, that, you know, like Wicked Witch of the East socks that are, you know, super tall, like whatever. Like, you know, I'm going to wear stuff that's the shiny, that like I'm going to wear stuff that just, you know, is like people, that was just cool. People didn't understand it. People didn't understand how I dressed, but like I was dressed like very kind of, you know, stylishly, kind of like whatever. But it was like kind of, and it was stuff that like became mainstream style, or that was on the edge of like mainstream style, and then eventually became the mainstream style. And I'm like, yeah, y'all were talking about me for all my stuff that you said didn't match, but like, yeah, you know, here I am, like this, like people are dressing exactly like I dressed, but okay, whatever. Dressing exactly like I dressed, except for they're wearing pants or whatever. But anyway, but you know, like I would, like, you know, I had, you know, Chuck Taylors that had like rainbow shoelaces in them. And like my Chuck Taylors, like I'd had them since I was in high school. So they had, you know, just like all this stuff like written on them, because that was the style back then. And so, you know, like, so people just saw that and like thought like, oh, she's different. Like she's different. She doesn't fit the UPC mold. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know how to talk to her. And so then the residue, we don't know how to talk to her. Like we don't know how to interact with her. And so the residue part of that then becomes where that was something that stuck with me. Like even after, you know, we left the UPC and, you know, we're in the church and people are kind of saying, but it's like, wow, like y'all are kind of biting my style a little bit, but whatever. It just like, that was something, but the way that people treated me stuck with me. And for, it took me a long time to not automatically think of myself as somehow like I'm doing something wrong, or I'm automatically inherently wrong or offbeat. Like people would say, and I like, it wasn't anything bad, but I just won't repeat any specific things that they said, but like they people made it like very clear that they thought I was weird. And that was something that like kind of, I think that they meant it like sometimes as a compliment, but it wasn't really a compliment. Like they meant it as a compliment perhaps, I think, you know, but it didn't feel like a compliment. And that was something that stuck with me. That stuck with me for a very long time.
And you know, that's something that illustrates the nature of a cult or a high control group. And isn't it strange that the very group that wants to be known as being different or being separate singled out you for a difference or a variation upon a particular clothing style. Mm-hmm. And that illustrates that, you know, this idea that there is a groupthink at work here, mm-hmm, that is enforcing a dress code certainly exists, because if it did not, then it would be like, I don't care how you dress. Come on, we love you. We celebrate your style. It's exactly different than ours, but yeah, let's go, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, you can, we're different, you know, we're the way that we dress, the way that we whatever is different, but it's different as long as you're the same. So it's like, we're going to be right, different. Like we are collectively going to be different, but you have to be different the same way that we're different. If you're not different the same way that we're different, then there's an issue. And like I said, you know, that was something that stuck with me for a while, of just a kind of my sense, and it stuck to my sense of self, in that like people are, my expectation then is that people are always going to like inherently mistrust me. They're always going to, because of how I carry myself, I'm always going to have to, you know, inherently like convince people to be able to trust me. And again, you know, I named it before and I want to name it again. There was also a healthy dose of racism in that, but I was sure, different, and I was different in ways that I couldn't change. So like, right, even if I, you know, had conformed in every other way, that I was still different in ways that I couldn't change. And I think that, you know, because some people might be like, well, how, what does race have to do with that? I think that you already, that it was the bias that people already had against people who look like me, and the bias of, you know, some of the inferior, because some of the things, the inferiority, the ideas of inferiority. So there were things, you know, just kind of inherent in UPC doctrine, in the overt teachings, but just inherent in kind of how the UPC moved with certain things, you know, the long hair. Like, so, you know, long uncut hair. The standard wasn't just, you know, uncut hair. The idea was like, you know, long uncut hair. Well, my hair, if you're watching this, if you see a video clip of this, you will be able to see that I have an afro. I did not have an afro. I didn't have an afro back then. I chemically straightened my hair, but the principle still holds up that the way that my hair grows, it's not that I don't have a lot of hair. It's not that I don't have a lot of hair and that my hair, you know, in theory couldn't grow long. It's that my hair grows differently. And so then the things that I would have to do to make my hair long in the UPC acceptable way also affects the length of you're putting, you know, caustic chemicals on your head, on your hair, that also affects the length that your hair can grow. It takes a lot of extra work and a lot of extra care to get it to the point where you're able for it to be long. And so, you know, some of the things, like, you know, whenever you start thinking about like body type and that type of stuff, that, you know, the holiness standards really like kind of favored skinny white women.
Right.
If you didn't fit that mold, then it was much, much, much harder for you to be accepted within the thing. Like, there was always going to be something, just a little something about you that was just a little, it was a little too different. Like, oh, you know, she's got big breasts. Like, ooh, you know, we gotta watch her. Like, because, you know, she might be wearing something that we're going to, that, you know, a woman that I do not have big breasts, but there are a lot of big breasted women in the UPC. And it's like, you know, the way, like, you know, there's always going to be a gap on them buttons, fam. Like,
yeah.
Like them shirts them blouses ain't going to fit you the way that is going to fit somebody who is less endowed in that area.
Right.
You know, it's harder. If you've got a booty, it's a lot harder to find a skirt that doesn't do, like, people would talk about, like, the skirt, like doing a butt tuck. So, like, the idea was like your skirt, you know, should be, you know, straight down, like kind of parallel lines. Like, it can flare out, like it can be voluminous, it can flare out, but the skirt can't be tight. And so, like, one of the standards that would be policed is like, oh, do you have a butt tuck? And so that's like, if the skirt like comes and it comes under your butt and like you can see like the definition of your butt. Now, I mean, there were some girls that they was skinny. And they were wearing pencil skirts. They maybe had a little bit of a booty, and they were wearing pencil skirts, and was out here clearly with a butt tuck, and it was like, oh, that person has a butt tuck. But there were some people that couldn't help it. Like, you just could, I mean, I did not have that problem. I did not have the butt tuck problem because I did not have a butt. But there are some people that some of the bigger girls, you're like, yeah, they got a butt. And like, what are you gonna do? Like, so it's like, you know, God's telling you that you can't have a butt? Like, it's just, and so,
yeah,
it's just,
exactly.
So it's just, again, like, and so, you know, you carry, and I know that people, you know, even, you know, after all of that, like, it gets hard to kind of change your mindset of like how you go out, like how you exist and whatnot. Like, to this day, like, I very rarely, I don't think I have any dresses or any clothes that don't come below the knee. Now, I do have short. I have started wearing shorts more, and so some of it's just like a matter of style for me. But now I do have some Daisy Dukes now. I do have some Daisy Dukes. But I mean, it was just one of those things where it's just like, in some ways it's like, you know, I don't even know if I feel like myself anymore. Like, just wear it. But before I was in the UPC, I wore jeans like every day. Like, I mean, I, like, even in the summer, like, I rarely wore shorts. So some of that is just kind of, you know, change from how I have been since I was in high school. But anyway, like, but again, stuff that sticks with you.
It stays with you. And I think that women certainly feel this after leaving a high control religion like the United Pentecostal Church, because so many of the standards, the holiness standards, are created to enforce a expectation of how women should dress. So, to police women's bodies, but this is true for men as well. I know it took me a long time to actually feel comfortable wearing shorts in public as a man. And I'm not wearing Daisy Dukes, right? But but I'm wearing just shorts. And for me to go out in public, there was always that twinge in the back of my mind that I shouldn't be doing this. And the problem in high control religious groups like this is that these expectations of behavior and dress are elevated, so it becomes the forefront of everyone's thoughts. And I'll share a short story before we go to the break that illustrates this. I remember an elderly woman who was a part of our church for a long time. She was considered to be one of the pillars of our local United Pentecostal church. And she knew me as a child, she knew me as a young adult, and she knew me early in my married life as I was becoming an evangelist and a minister, not only in our church, but also in the wider United Pentecostal church. And I remember that she was on her deathbed. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm on my deathbed, it seems to me that that is the time in my life that I'm going to prioritize certain things above others. But when I had my last conversation with her, I went to visit her, and this was shortly before she died, and I was going to pray with her and express my thanks to her for her investment in my life. I remember that intertwined into the conversation was a rebuke about how my wife chose to dress, about how my wife chose to wear her hair, and how this was hurting, in her words, my ministry, and how she wanted to leave some money for my wife to buy a quote unquote modest, holy dress. Now, this woman is on her deathbed, right? And this, at the end of her life, because she had been conditioned all of her life that these things were the most important things. She felt moved to talk to me about this before she died. And that shows the power of these particular behavioral codes, especially when it comes to policing the bodies of women.
Oh my God. So I have to make sure that I understand this. Yes. So this woman is knocking on heaven's door.
Right.
She's got one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel.
Yeah.
And she gonna talk to you about how your wife is dressed. Girl, you dying.
That's, exactly.
Lord Jesus, I cannot.
Well, we'll continue this conversation on the other side of the break. You're listening to High Control. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with Ali Henney. And we're talking about the residue that remains in our lives on the other side of high-control religious groups like the United Pentecostal Church. We'll be back in just a moment with more. Welcome back to the High Control Podcast. I'm hosting this episode. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my friend Ali Henney. And today we're talking about residue, or the small parts that remain of a larger part that has been removed. And in this context, we're talking about our experiences in the United Pentecostal Church and some of the other, in Ali's case, some of the other high control religious groups that she was a part of. And Ali, before the break, we were talking about the fact that so much of what happened within the context of the UPC was designed in policing the bodies and the dress and the behavior of women and men to a certain extent, and how when you leave that high control group, the residue of what you were conditioned to believe about how you should behave, about where you should go, about what you should participate in, it stays with you. I know for a long time, anytime I would go to a movie and I would enjoy the movie, coming out of the movie, I kind of looked around to make sure, you know, who was seeing me. And I don't know why I felt that way, except that it was a leftover impact of all of those years that I was told that you shouldn't go to the movies. And quite interestingly, all of those prohibitions started at a time when it wasn't necessarily about what was being shown on the screen, but it was the perception of how people behaved mm-hmm. in the movie house. So back in the day when movies were a novelty, right? It was a dark place. And a lot of the people that grew up in that time, they were taught not to go to a movie house because that was a dark place where people were fornicating and drinking and corralling and doing all of these things. And certainly as the culture changed, that attitude towards the movie house, the theater, did not change, and it had to be corrected somewhat. So then the target became, well, we're not necessarily concerned about what's going on in the theater as much as we are about what's being shown on the screen. And that's the problem with a lot of these behavioral codes, is that over time the target has to change because the culture moves on. And the high control religious groups have to find new justifications for their behavioral codes or adjust how they enforce those. And I have noticed that in the UPC that there have been adjustments, minor adjustments, and that's fine. But what I wish would happen, I wish the United Pentecostal Church and other groups like them would be more self-aware and would simply have the intellectual honesty to come out and say, you know what, we were wrong about some things and we have changed. But they can't do that because the high control religious group must always maintain this aura of inerrancy, that we are right on every particular mm-hmm. issue, because mm-hmm. if they deviate from that proclamation, then it opens the door for everything to be questioned. And in order to maintain their power and their control over a particular group, then they have to maintain this. And at some point, it becomes the tail wagging the dog, right?
Yeah.
Even if the leaders want to change or want to lead in a different direction, they have to do it slowly, and they have to do it incrementally, because if they do it too fast, there's a whiplash effect. And the people that have grown up in this system get mad and get upset and get confused, and there's a mass exodus. Mm-hmm. And that's when you have factions. And I remember a few years ago when the UPC was trying to do this, that there was an entire group of churches and ministers that left the UPC that simply said, you know what, you're not strict enough. You're not conservative enough. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take our group and we're going to go over here and form our own little faction. And there's groups that leave on the other side as well that say, well, we don't like the dress codes, but we're going to embrace the doctrine and we're going to remain adherent to that. And we're going to insist on that. And for those groups, it becomes a bait and switch, right? Because they get you in the door like, oh, we're just like every other church out there. Mm-hmm. But once you're in the door, it's like, well, you have to be baptized in Jesus' name in order to go to heaven. You have to speak in tongues in mm-hmm. order to go to heaven. And they have their own expectations as well. So what this demonstrates on an organizational level is that no matter how you might see it from your own particular perspective, the residue of those high control groups is so strong and so influential that even if you leave, you're going to struggle with still being controlled by the overarching ideas that you were conditioned to believe that were true for so long.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's definitely true. And I think we've demonstrated that with the UPC, but I think that mindset, it translates to other groups. And so, you know, for our listeners, I think that the way that you can think about it, because you might have had a UPC background, or you might be somebody that maybe you were part of a different group and you might be like, you know, how does that translate? How does that go forward? I think that anything you think about, like maybe what your group's distinctives are or were, and then think about what it would take for those distinctives to change. or if you're leaving, if there are things that maybe you're kind of in conflict, or things that are in dispute or whatever, what are you, or what are people within the group, what are the things, the ideas that they are carrying with them? Even if there's, you know, conflict or whatever, they feel like, if we lose this distinctive, or if we lose this thing, then, you know, our identity is shot. So I think about with the prayer movement, with the charismatic 24-hour prayer movement, one of the things, you know, IHOP is embroiled in this sex abuse scandal. And the thing that a lot of people are arguing about or care about is the maintaining of 24-hour prayer. And so that's, they are sitting here maintaining that 24-hour a day prayer, barely doing it, barely making it. I think that they actually are still doing it, because I think that we would know if they talk about like keeping the fire on the altar. And I think that somebody would say like they are not having a prayer meeting. At this time, there was not a prayer meeting. Like I think, or maybe there's just not enough people there anymore that maybe they could get away with not having some of those prayer meetings. But I think that if the prayer meetings did stop, we would know for a fact that they had stopped, because people would be like, oh my God, you know, it's stopped. But there's this kind of fight within even the survivor community of the 24-hour prayer movement, this idea that this prayer movement that's been going on in Kansas City for almost 25 years, this year, started in September of 1999, there are people who are just kind of like, yeah, IHOP needs to shut down. Like, you know, who cares if they stop praying? God is everywhere. There are people praying everywhere. This whole idea of maintaining this thing is foolhardy. It was foolhardy before, but it certainly is now. But then you have people who are sympathetic to the fact that this prayer meeting has been going. It's a streak. It's like somebody like Duolingo streak. Like you don't get a streak freeze for the prayer meeting. We've got to keep the prayer meeting going. Like we've got to keep your 24-hour prayer going. And there are people that might leave a place like IHOP, but might still carry with them the mindset of like a 24-hour prayer. Like it's good. It's, you know, something that, you know, there should be 24-hour prayer rooms. There should be all this other type of stuff. And so all that to say that, you know, this residue is stuff that you hold on to. It might be beliefs or practices that you hold on to from the high control group. And I think that the way that we see those things, the way that we see and understand it as residue, is understanding like what is it that people are insistent of keeping with them. I think that also the other thing could be too, you can also kind of work it in the negative of what's the thing that people are most likely to free themselves from or want to free themselves from. And I also want to say, you know, that residue doesn't always have to be bad. It doesn't always have to be a negative thing. There can be tools, there can be practices, there can be, you know, basic kind of general ideas that aren't necessarily related to controlling people or whatever, but things that you're like, oh, this is something that could be positive. I don't want to say that all residue is bad residue. I think that for the most part, residue, tends to be negative. The things that kind of get in your mind and get in your soul or your spirit or whatever, and cause you to have negative feelings or cause you to kind of question yourself or are things or aspects of the cult programming that you are taking with you in your non-cult life. Like I think that there is, that in general residue is bad. But I think that there can also be some positive ways that residue shows up. So, you know, something that I think about going back to the IHOP community, Mike Bickle essentially built this army of most like Gen X elder millennials and some younger millennials and some Gen Z, but the most of us who are like pushing back against this thing are Gen X and elder millennials. And he created an army of people because, you know, his whole thing was, you know, Joel's in time army, blah, 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 blah. Well, he created this army of people who know how to use media, who know how to use messaging, who will work themselves to death for a cause that they believe is righteous. And he created that army to build a 24-hour prayer room in South Kansas City. But that army, those same people that just, you know, have that just extreme devotion, extreme whatever, those are the same people who are taking him down right now, who are taking the ministry down right now because of the skills, because of the mindsets, because of all those things that we learned being part of this movement. He's essentially, I think, written his own undoing into that. But that I think about that residue, like, you know, and some of the people that I've been working with within like that prayer movement survivor community, we are so dedicated and so like we have these skills of being able to organize people and being able to do all this other type of stuff. And those were skills that we learned there. And so that's residue. And there are some things, you know, that I've said within that you can be like, oh yeah, that could maybe kind of be unhealthy. It absolutely can. We absolutely, you know, have to, you know, be like, you know, you gotta rest, you gotta take a step back, you gotta whatever. So there's ways that we have to you know, deal with ourselves and monitor ourselves and help ourselves. But at the same time, that can be used for good, and it can be used for good even, you know, outside of, you know, taking that dude down. But those are skills, and those are positive traits that we fostered. Some of us, of course, you know, we had. I think that the prayer movement and that IHOP kind of selects for a certain kind of intense personality type anyway. So these are things that we had, but the institution helped, I guess, solidify and kind of funnel some of those things, some of those channels, some of those skills. And so we're able to use those things then to the institution's detriment.
I think that's well said, and absolutely to your point that a lot of the residue can be positive as well. And I think I've mentioned this before, but looking back on my formative years and experiences in the United Pentecostal Church, I'll always be grateful for the fact that my local church, my local iteration of the larger United Pentecostal Church, gave me the gift of reading and understanding the Bible, specifically the King James Version of the Bible. Now, since then, I've learned a lot about the Bible. My views on the Bible have changed and evolved over the years. But I think those formative years and those formative experiences of committing scripture to memory and learning to read the Bible in context and consider its historical setting and who it was written to originally, that helped me later on in life as I began to read and digest more difficult passages and books and concepts and ideas. And just generally speaking, the Pentecostal movement in general, there's a lot of good scholarship that is happening right now that is exploring the ways that the global Pentecostal movement, of which the United Pentecostal Church is a very small tributary that, in my estimation, has gone off the deep end, to keep my metaphors consistent, has gone off the deep end into cult-like and certainly control-like, high control-like behavior. But the innovations of Azusa Street and William Seymour and a lot of global understandings of the Bible and theology that has evolved and morphed through the years, I would not have that diversity of appreciation had it not been for the larger Pentecostal movement, of which my small church was but one expression. So I'm grateful for those particular gifts. I'm grateful for the artistic expression and the emotive expression of many parts of the church, as far as music, as far as creating an aesthetic and contributing to that in a lot of ways, has helped shape my perspective and view of the world. But to return to some of the negative connotations, and this is something that we have periodically talked about in our series here, what grinds my gears is that the moment that I raise my voice or others do so to critique or to offer criticism or to push back against some of the controlling aspects of the group that we were a part of, we are immediately labeled as bitter. We're labeled as a heretic. We're labeled as someone who can't view a particular experience or a particular movement in a nuanced way. And so, you know, a lot of times when we have conversations like this, or when we bring up topics like this, people say, "Well, you're just they say you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater," meaning that you've totally turned your back on Jesus, you've turned your back on Christianity, and just because I question some of the earlier beliefs that I have, doesn't mean that I'm bitter. Does it mean that I've experienced some bitter moments? Absolutely. But that doesn't negate the fact that if people were willing, were intellectually and otherwise humble enough to say, you know what, we need to consider some of these critiques that are being leveraged against us, and especially acknowledge the larger historical narrative that informs everything that we are today, we need to be more introspect and say, we do have problems. We have changed. There are issues that we need to deal with. And the changes haven't always been positive. And a lot of times through these unintended consequences of otherwise good intentions, we are perpetuating harm and real trauma into the lives of individuals. And instead of saying, well, those are just isolated individual experiences when people express outrage or hurt or trauma that they've experienced within the United Pentecostal Church, wouldn't it be more Christ-like to say, you know what, we may have a problem here. How many people have to speak up before it moves beyond just an individual isolated incident? And that's something that grinds my gears. I wish more people in the United Pentecostal Church, and especially in leadership, would address the major exodus that is happening, not only in the church world generally, but also in these small groups, and the reasons that people say they are leaving.
So my grinds my gears is along some of those very same lines. Something that really frustrates me with high control groups is that the moment that you step outside, the moment that you sort of turn a critical eye toward the group as an outsider, and actually that bugs me, and I'm gonna hopefully get to that here in a minute. But the minute that you step outside and you say, you know, actually, it's not safe in here. Actually, you know, this place got roaches. This place has got rats and roaches. People get defensive and they shut down and they don't want to hear that you maybe still care about people who are inside the house. You maybe still care in some shape or form about the institution. You might even, depending on where you're at in your journey, you might even want to be able to return to the institution. There's not really any of the institutions that I've been part of that I necessarily would want to return to. I would have loved to have been able to remain Pentecostal and charismatic. I'm an Episcopalian now. I would have loved to have been able to remain Pentecostal and charismatic, and to be able to be in those churches and ordained in those churches, and even, you know, to be part of a prayer movement of sorts. But, you know, some of my things are, I need for y'all to, you know, not treat queer people like trash, and to accept them, and to accept them in full personhood, and to allow them to live and move and have their being. And so I can't really like, you know, be down. I'm like, I'm not down with that. Like, I can't remain someplace that doesn't fit in with that. And so I've removed myself from those contexts, but there's aspects of my spirituality that still are very Pentecostal and still are very charismatic. My whole theological journey, there's more that I can say about that I won't for the interest of time. But it bothers me that the critique is seen as an issue. And then the other thing that bothers me, and this is something that we've seen in the IHOP crisis, where people who have left, who are familiar with the institution, who are familiar with all of this, are suddenly treated like outsiders and treated as if they didn't, you know, have any type of value within the system. And so specifically, like within the IHOP crisis, it was former leaders of IHOP, like some of the top leaders, former board members, people who were people of influence that their names are known in those circles, found out that Mike Bickle had abused someone and had abused multiple people. They brought it to the institution. They brought it to him, and the institution failed. And the first thing that the institution did was to try to set people like Alan Hood and Dwayne Roberts and Wes Martin, who Alan was the second in command at IHOP for like 20 years, and immediately tried to set them as like they were outsiders, and their opinion and their observations and their nothing, it didn't matter. And it was done by people who were their friends, who had served alongside of them. And that is something that really grinds my gears, because again, it's like, just because you have left something doesn't mean that you forfeit your ability to be able to critique it. And that's something that I've experienced in an abusive church that I was part of, that, you know, the minute that you step outside the door, well, all of a sudden, you know, the pastor doesn't want to hear your critique. He didn't want to hear anything that anybody else has to say, because he didn't want to hear it whenever you were there. Because I mean, if he wanted to hear it, well, you know, you were there, then he would have heard it. So really, the truth is, like, he didn't want to hear it in any circumstances. Yeah. You know, he didn't want to hear it on a plane. He didn't want to hear it on a train. He didn't want to hear it in the air. He didn't want to hear it from a bear. He did not want green eggs at Hab. He did not want it, Sam, I am. But anyway, like, that's just the way that folks in these types of groups move. And there's never a good time to critique it. There's never a good time to say, you know, actually, I don't like what's happening here. Because if you're on the inside and you do it, then you're a problem. And then they do little things to try to force you out. But then whenever you're out and you're critiquing it, it's still not a good time. So it's like, when is it a good time to bring up that, you know, this system is abusing people? This system is harming people. There are things going on in the system that straight up do not make sense. That straight up just, this is weird. This is causing us problems. We can't live the standards to live here. The standards to be in this house are impossible to abide by, but they don't want to listen. And they don't want to accept that critique. They don't want to accept that criticism. And that really, really upsets me, because it's like, you know, whatever the thing is aside, and you know, I understand, you know, that if you're listening to this show, you probably think, like, you know, high control groups like suck and there's nothing, no redeeming qualities, and there's no redeeming values to them. And I would tend to agree with that. I would tend to agree with the fact that if you put a seed in the ground and the seed was sick whenever you put it in the ground, that it's probably not just going to automatically, you know, get better. Like if it's bad at the root, like it's bad. And so I am not one for trying to like redeem institutions that, like, at the root, this thing inherently was founded, it was built on bullcrap, and it perpetuates bullcrap. I'm just not a fan of that. But I also want to be charitable and say that, you know, I also understand that it's very possible for a high control group for there to be things that were valuable to people within it. Because, you know, you wouldn't have stayed for the amount of time that you did if there wasn't value to it. And so I think that for some people, it's a struggle because you leave because, you know, that was the right move. That was the healthy thing to do. But then you leave, and then going back to that piece that you talked about, Scott, with you lose your identity. You know, who are you? Who are you if not a person who was a member of that organization? Who are you but for your position and place within the system or within the organization? And so I think that a lot of people who leave high control groups struggle. And I think that why sometimes there's like a recidivism rate within people leaving a group and then matriculating back into the group, or matriculating into other high control groups, because there's something within some individuals that, you know, there's something that you're looking for. There's something that you want, and those needs don't even have to necessarily be anything bad. You know, I think that it can be easy to pathologize and be like, oh, you know, there's some deep need that's blah, 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 not being met, blah, 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 blah. I don't think it has to be that. I think it can be very human things of wanting meaning, of wanting a purpose, of seeing the world as bigger and more connected than yourself, and wanting to see good in the world, and these groups exploiting that for you. So then you end up in another group because you end up in another group, you end up in another movement, you end up in another thing because that part of you is being exploited and taken advantage of. I don't think that there's something wrong with you because, you know, you decide to go back, or you hold a sympathetic view toward your old high control group. Like I think that, you know, I understand that some people in their journey, they need to be like, you know, I left whatever the group is, and I hate that group, and I hate everything about it, and I hate whatever. And you know, we're all in different places in our journey. You know, there's things that, I mean, you know, I think that because I have like no deep longing for, you know, the UPC in any kind of ways. It's something that is just straight up, I would not go back there because I would not be welcome there. I actually, you know, have a UPC pastor who occasionally will get in contact with me. And it's kind of a weird situation. I won't go into all the details of it, but it's kind of weird. But there's been a couple of times whenever I've had some trouble, and this UPC pastor has, you know, jumped up and been like, you know, hey, and this, you know, has tried to talk to me, whatever. And it's like, you know, I've kept distance and kept boundaries there because it's like, I'm not going to end up at your church. Like, I'm not gonna right. be like, I'm like, I feel like I know, like, there might be genuine concern there for me. It's hard for me to believe that because you weren't ever really my pastor, but, you know, we knew each other in just some of the circumstances we interacted and whatever. But it's like, you know, but this person pastored a church where I lived, and it's like, you know what? I'm like, I'm never gonna go to your church. Like I would not be welcome at your church, just like off rip. I walk in with my, I'm not taking my nose ring out. So I walk in with a nose ring that automatically disqualifies me from anything in your church. So like, I'm just like, from being treated with any kind of semblance of I'm a believer in Jesus in your church. And so like, I'm not going to do that. You know, I have said, you know, before to my partner that, like, you know, there, I don't miss being part of the prayer movement, but I don't miss being part of the 24-hour prayer movement at all, really. But something that leaving that I lost within that was, you know, being able to, because I'm a very spiritual person. I'm a very, like, that's who I am. Very, very spiritual, very prayerful, very whatever. And something that I lost in, even all before all this happened with IHOP, but something that I lost was being able to listen to the IHOP web stream and being able to hear the music and being able to pray and all that other type of stuff. I lost that years before there was anything at the house, because it's like, I can't listen. I'm not going to listen to these prayer meetings. I'm not going to, whatever. These folks be popping off with racism. They be popping off with homophobia. They be popping off with all this type of stuff. And I'm not trying to hear it. They be popping off with Christian nationalism and whatever. And it's like, I am not trying to hear it, because that's immediately, I'm going to lose the Holy Ghost immediately. Whenever that stuff pops off. So like you, I would be in the spirit and then not be immediately. Right. So there was like kind of like, you know, yeah, that you know, kind of sucks. And like, you know, as an Episcopalian, you know, I've got the daily office, I've got the daily prayers and stuff that we do. As a, within NSSA that we do, there's no requirement or mandate or whatever, but there's resources within my current tradition for that, but it's not the same. And right. So it grinds my gears that, you know, I, at this point, like, again, you know, IHOP got rats and roaches. Like, I'm not trying to be up in there with them people. You know, as much as I care about what's happening there and I care about the human collateral, it's not where I am theologically or whatever. But I still lament that place couldn't be a safe place for me, and it couldn't be a safe place for my queer siblings who there's a lot of them who were part of the community. And there's something within that I lament. And so it grinds my gears that these places they don't want to listen and take to heart the things that we're saying. It's like, we didn't leave because we were bitter and angry or whatever. We left because we could no longer stay. And like, people just don't want to, they don't want to hear that.
There's a lot you said that's so important. And as we come to a conclusion of this episode and our first season on High Control, I think one of the big takeaways for me is that human relationships, humans in general, are very complex creations. And all of us have a complexity to us. And when you involve that within relationships and within groups, the complexity is compounded. And looking back at my experiences in the United Pentecostal Church, certainly it is a mixed bag. There was some good, but there was a whole lot of bad. And my beef isn't necessarily with people that choose to remain, even with leaders that choose to remain. But my beef is, and my complaint and my lament is over the systemic nature of the high control that continues to be perpetuated, and no one is willing to step up and say, you know what? We've got some real problems here that we need to address. And this is true for the United Pentecostal Church. This is true for any group, for any human institution. But we can say that if human institutions are on a spectrum, that there are a lot of these groups that are towards the end of the spectrum that are doing irreparable harm to what it means to be a human being and what it means to flourish as a human in the world. And at any point where we are part of a system that is perpetuating harm, that is causing devastating harms on the human psyche, and in a lot of respects to the expression of human beings physically, emotionally, intellectually, I think we need to stop, and we need to either leave, or we need to take drastic steps to reform or to end the existence of that particular institution. And I hope that our listeners, wherever you find yourself, whether you're still a part of one of these groups and you're trying to find the wherewithal to leave, or the courage to leave, or the information that you need to finally to walk out the door, or if you're like us on the other side of that and still dealing with the ramifications of your choice to leave, I hope that you've found some encouragement. I hope that you found some information. I hope that you found some validation for what you're feeling and for what you are experiencing. So Allie, I'll give you the last word on this idea of residue.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope that for our listeners that you recognize that there might be aspects of your experience that maybe you're still holding on to, or there might be little things like the phobias, the different things that we've talked about over the course of the season, things that pull at your heart, things that pull at your mind, at your sense of well-being or whatever. And that's okay. And it is a process. Recovering from being part of a high control group is a process. And you get more okay as time goes on. There can be things that kind of send you back and kind of send you right into it. And like, again, it's like, you know, being like Michael Corleone, like, you know, you pull, like, right, just whenever you thought you was out, you get pulled right back in. And that does happen. And, you know, if and when that happens, there's nothing wrong with you. It's the time, it's the investment of your resources, of your abilities, of your whatever. Like, there's something there that's pulling on your heartstrings. And whenever those moments happen where maybe you're feeling down, when maybe, you know, you're somewhat like you're fresh out the box, right? You know, you just got out like a month ago, or you just got out, you know, 4 months ago or 6 months ago or something like that. And maybe there are things that are trying to pull you in. Maybe there are interactions that you have where people are trying to pull you in. Maybe there's moments where, you know, you seek closure. So maybe you visit some of those old spaces, that some of your old haunts, some of the old places that you used to be part of. And that's all natural. That's all a natural part of the process of recovery. And, you know, even finding your way back in, potentially, that can be part of the recovery process. Sometimes relapse happens in the course of recovery, and hopefully relapse stops and it ceases. But if it doesn't cease, maybe it becomes less frequent, and maybe hopefully at some point you're really able to fully extract yourself. And but all that to say that it's okay to feel your feelings, and all of your feelings are valid. All of your feelings might not be true, but they're valid. And you know, it's up to you to be able to parse through and to find your sense of what the truth is. And you know, as a member of a high control group, especially, I think this is true for religions, but I think it's true for all high control groups, that there is a molding of what the truth is, and there is a telling and a teaching too of people what the truth is, but you have to find the truth for yourself. And so the truth might mean existing. It might mean placing distance. It might mean completely extracting yourself. But I hope that this show helps you on your journey, wherever you're at in your recovery journey. If you're, you know, 10 minutes, 10 years, you know, like 15, 20 years out of your recovery, wherever you're at, I hope that you have found these discussions to be valuable. I hope that you found our rants and rambles to be something that you find yourself within those things and are able to relate it back to your own experience and find health and healing from that.
In the words of Jesus, the truth shall indeed set you free. So thank you all for listening to Allie and myself on the High Control Podcast. I will let you know that we're already talking about a second season, but a lot of that depends on your response. So we need to hear from you. We need to hear your comments. Send us an email, like and share and subscribe to the podcast, and go back and listen to some of the episodes, and let us know how the content is resonating with you. And make sure to hit that subscribe button, because that way you'll be notified first when our second season debuts. So let us hear from you.
Yeah. I'm excited for season two, but yeah, absolutely. Season two, I told you not to be controlling, not to be weird, culty about it. Like, you know, the second season, you know, we're like, it's not to be weird about it, but it's just like, you know, we're trying to do something that we feel like might be beneficial to people. So if it's beneficial to you, like, no pressure. Like, you know, we're not trying to recruit you into a cult or anything. Right. Like, no pressure at all. But if you have enjoyed this, please, please, please rate, subscribe, like, follow, do all of the things.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Scott Lloyd for Allie Henney. This has been the High Control Podcast, and we encourage all of you to stay in control.
You've been listening to High Control. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to our show. You can catch us on social media at High Control Pod. Check the show notes for resources and how to get in touch. Stay in control, friends.